Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. William Dub Lawrence served as sheriff of Davis County, just north of Salt Lake City in Utah, in the 1970s. While he was sheriff, he formed the SWAT team that 30 years later ended up killing his son-in-law. Lawrence talks with WPSU's Emily Reddy about his story and about the increased militarization of police.
Dub Lawrence, thanks for talking with us.
It's good to be here, Emily. Thank you so much.
So SWAT teams, or Special Weapons and Tactics teams, were first created in the 60s to handle riots, bank robberies, but eventually they became pretty commonplace. You started a SWAT team in Davis County, Utah in 1975. Why did you create that SWAT team?
I wanted to be on the front with the best equipment, the best training that was available for my personnel as sheriff. And I wanted my men and women in the department to be as trained and as qualified and as professional as I could make them. As a Marine, we were always trained to be able to handle any kind of a situation. And I found when I first went into the sheriff's office, the weapons were somewhat obsolete. We were using 38 caliber revolvers with six shots and bullets in our, on our belts. And we were often situations happened that was just much, you know, if a criminal's got a sawed-off shotgun, a 38 pistol's not much of a match for that. And I think it was the right thing to do at that time. I'm disappointed that we've gone too far in the last 30, 40 years. I think now using the SWAT team to do kicking in doors in the middle of the night, serving search warrants for drugs. The drug war has changed our whole approach since the 70s when I implemented that program.
I want to talk about that more, but I wondered if we could talk about what happened with your son-in-law. Brian Wood was his name. So about 30 years after you created that SWAT team, and perhaps a very different-looking SWAT team from the one you created, they ended up killing him. And it appeared, it seems like he was having some kind of a mental breakdown at the time.
There's no question. Brian was having some problems. He had, it was a domestic violence situation where he was very upset.
There was a standoff between him and the police.
He actually called 911 and told the dispatcher that he had just assaulted his wife, and actually the recording of the 911 call was, "I just beat and raped my wife." Now, my daughter says that didn't happen, but he put a gun to his head and went outside and got in his truck. I was trained differently than what I witnessed. I arrived about 7 minutes after that call came in. I was there. I watched the officers as they approached. I watched during the whole standoff, and I was very disappointed and upset at the way it was handled. There were 46 SWAT officers, and all these officers that trained together, they had a live suspect that gave them opportunity to practice their techniques, use different weapons, everything from a robot to flashbangs and 40-millimeter gas rounds. They fired into the truck and forced him out of the truck, and then he had the gun to his head standing beside the truck. They tased him, knocked him to the ground, and then a sniper that wasn't even supposed to be there actually took the fatal shot as he was being tased, laying on the ground. And they tased him for 50 seconds continuously.
And you trusted law enforcement up until this point. You thought they would end this situation without anyone getting hurt.
I actually, until I watched and observed during the course of this day, I actually thought that they would. I had told his father and mother, I told my family, my children, you trust them. You know, they know what they're doing. They're professional. They know what they're doing. But what I observed, the more I watched, the more I observed, I realized that here are some people with different attitude. You know, I mean, there are lots of ways of communicating with people that would have worked there are tactics that would have worked without killing him.
And your story and this investigation that you've done, a personal investigation, not as an officer, you haven't been a police officer in many years, is the focus of the documentary film Peace Officer. Well, let me play a clip to give a taste of the from the very beginning of this documentary.
Oh, okay, that'd be great.
He is down. Shot fired. He is down.
What happens to a community when the police are federally equipped with militarized weaponry?
What we see is just a massive increase in the use of SWAT teams. We're looking at a 15,000% increase since the late 1970s. Is that an appropriate government action? Is that an appropriate use of force?
So in the early 70s, SWAT teams did a few hundred raids a year across the country. In recent years, estimates say SWAT teams do maybe 80,000 raids a year. They might be deployed when there's a hostage situation, but also doing things like serving arrest warrants and search warrants, like you mentioned.
What's happened since, I think we could trace it back to Richard Nixon era, when the war on drugs was declared. I mean, if you declare war, then you can kind of forget that we have a constitution, you know, because no unreasonable search and seizure is the guarantee. It's one of our Bill of Rights. To me, it's a violation of the basic fundamental principle of our country, you know, to kick in doors in the middle of the night with 10 guys armed to the hilt and open fire on somebody.
Don't you think that police could say things went wrong that time, but criminals have these dangerous weapons and police have the right to protect themselves in these instances? You know, why shouldn't they protect themselves with military grade body armor and assault weapons to defend themselves?
Yes, absolutely correct. And that's basically what I did in my tenure as a county sheriff. But it was the mental state. It wasn't using weapons to overpower and force. It was using weapons to diffuse and neutralize and eliminate. If we had killed somebody, or it had to be the very last resort. Life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. I mean, those are basic fundamental principles that we abandon when we give an officer a tank and allow him to blow up a building because there's a suspect in there.
This documentary shows you looking into a few different cases, which you mentioned, in addition to your son-in-law's, where SWAT teams are used. One of them is the raid of the home of Matthew Stewart. He was growing marijuana in his basement. He was ex-military, says he thought he was being robbed. There's a shootout. Six officers are shot, one fatally. You investigate what happened there and talk with Stewart's father and sister.
Yeah, that case, I spent 22 months, and one of the interesting things about that, I had camera crews. Scott and Brad and their teams, they followed me, and because that was that happened 3 or 4 years after Brian's case, and we were working on the film at that time. And when that happened, I talked with Mike Stewart, Matthew's father, and I asked him if we could take custody of the scene and reconstruct that crime scene the day the police released it. And so we kept it contained and secure. And I spent 22 months and every time we got to a point where we could, we found something or we found something what might be, we brought the crews in and they videotaped it as we uncovered evidence. And I was able to direct the investigation and use really good qualified help. And I found 54 bullets that the police had missed. They had found 31. We found 54 that they'd left. And a couple of those bullets were very important. The police should never have left this. This is another technique that they've learned to use. If evidence is contaminated, you can't use it in court. And if officers make mistakes and the evidence is not preserved and processed and forensically determined, then you don't have any way to use that. So the officers, in some cases, they're bright, they're smart, they know what they're doing. So we found a lot of evidence that was left. There were two of those officers that were shot in crossfire. And so Matthew David Stewart did not shoot them.
Has any of this ever proven? I know that at the end of the documentary, it says Stewart's family sued for damages on the house so that your evidence from investigating could be heard in court. What came of that?
They settled out of court for an undisclosed amount. In the Daniel Willard case, they settled. In the film, it shows where it was found unjustified. They settled for $1.425 million. In the Matthew David Stewart case, that was an insurance claim for damages to the house. You know, when you fire 114 rounds in the house, it's pretty well shot up and destroyed. They busted the door down. They busted windows and shot out windows. They shot out the front door. They destroyed the house. And so this is a contaminated crime scene before we even see it. And the judge, you know, obviously is going to say, and the county attorney is going to say, they can't use this. You know, it's contaminated. That's a rule of criminal procedure. You know, it's the law of the land. So if you can't use the evidence, you can't get a conviction. But it was so compelling, it was so obvious that there was a cover-up or incompetence, or there was evidence that should have been collected that wasn't.
And that did lead police to settle.
Yeah, the insurance companies and the county, the judge allowed them to settle out of court to avoid having to, and there's reasons why court cases are settled, either embarrassment or a possibility of a scandal.
This is Take Note. If you're just joining us, we're talking with Dub Lawrence. In the documentary Peace Officer, he talks about the increased militarization of police and the surge of SWAT teams across the United States.
In another SWAT raid story from the documentary, you talk to a young family with kids who was raided. Turned out police had the wrong house.
Yeah, that was the Eric Hill case in Ogden. That is just an example of using a SWAT team or a drug task force, undercover officers dressed as civilians, and the people had no idea it was police.
And they thought the father was AWOL from the military.
Yeah, he was. He'd never even been in the military. And so the police made a mistake that could have, again, cost life. And it's one of many examples that happen across the country with misinformation and in cases where the officers have not done their homework enough to conduct such a raid. And again, the most important thing here, what in the world is a local police department doing with an armed SWAT team in the middle of the night at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning knocking on somebody's door to chase down an AWOL, a person who's AWOL.
Well, and he hears the knocking and comes to the door with a baseball bat.
And the thing that the officer says is, it's a good thing you came with the Louisville Slugger. You know, if you'd have come with your rifle, I'd have killed you. I'd have shot you. Yeah. And he said, well, I had a right. I could have come to the door with a shotgun. I had every right to, but he would have been dead on his floor if he had. And so the circumstances, it was just one of the examples that shows the truth about how far we've come in allowing the protocol, the rules, the policy, the procedure of law enforcement agencies to allow citizens, innocent citizens, to be subjected to possible death in the middle of the night with raids that basically are unconstitutional. It shouldn't even happen in the first place.
And the numbers we've been talking about for, you know, potential numbers of SWAT raids, we talked about, you know, maybe around 80,000, they're estimates because for the most part, it's not something that's well tracked. No. But Utah passed a law in 2014 after the Matthew Stewart raid and became the first and I believe still the only state where police have to report about how and how often they use their SWAT teams.
Yes. And since they've started doing that, I think the statistics will bear this out, that it's had a very positive impact. The police, their tactics that they claimed was 80% effective, I don't like those statistics because that means 20% are failures. People are getting killed because of these 20% of the time it doesn't work. But throwing flashbangs into a person's garage when they got a gun to their head, you know, is not something you do to a person who is already traumatized, who's already mentally off balance. If he's got a gun to his head threatening suicide, there's something wrong. And he needs some help. And as a human being, you don't kill a person to keep them from killing themselves. I mean, where's the logic?
I thought it was interesting. They looked at the numbers in Utah after they started tracking things and found that 78% of cases were about illegal drugs.
Yep.
Which some might say, why would you go to that extent for illegal drugs? Others would say they're illegal and police are enforcing the law here.
Again, it's the law. I have always taken issue with the war on drugs. Our whole society has been totally sabotaged with the war on drugs. When a person gets hooked on controlled substances, on something that is addictive, it's a psychological addiction, it's a physical addiction, it's a medical addiction. I mean, it's a problem that has to be solved medically. Even if you put them in prison, it doesn't solve the problem, you know, until they can be treated and restored to normalcy. I have seen so many cases. When I was county sheriff, it was just the beginning stages of the drug, you know, back in the 70s and 80s. And seeing these kids, and usually it's poor kids, in my jail. I can tell you from my jail, I found that it was unfair. It was unjust. It was disproportionate. And I didn't like the idea of plea bargaining in the first place. That's another issue I fought in the 70s and 80s. To allow the attorneys to bargain, you know, to cut a deal and go to the judge and get him off, you know, to charge what it did, the effect that it had, it started officers stacking cases. So if you get stopped for something, you'll get charged with five or six different offenses. And even if you hadn't done anything, you know, they're going to make one stick. And the only way to get out of all these charges, you post a lot of bail, you spend more time in jail, there's a higher risk, you pay more money. And so it becomes a self-perpetuating flaw in our system. So today, I look at our criminal justice system as being broken for more than just the mental attitude of officers, but because of the laws that they are enforcing. And emphasizing drugs as a criminal offense, most of these people are in prison because of laws that say, for example, mandatory 5 years if you have a gun in your possession, if you commit a felony. They get 2 years for the felony and 5 years for having a gun. So they spend 7 years. Even if you get off with good behavior, you got a mandatory 5-year sentence. So if you look at the California, for example, they adopted not only tough on crime, they went further than just mandatory sentencing. They went with three strikes, you're out. And a person could commit any kind of a violation, and you go away for a mandatory sentencing. So their prison system is by far the largest departmental budget in California's government is corrections. And they're building prisons that they can't house all the people that are in prison. We've got 2.8 million people in this country that are in prison. And a large percentage of those are nonviolent, that are there because of the laws that were put in place as a consequence of the war on drugs. And the big people, I mean the people who are actually profiting by the millions and billions that are bringing drugs into the country, the laws are not, they're not enforced equally. People with money or power or influence are more equal than poor people.
Looking at this the law that the Utah legislature made, it says in addition to requiring reporting of numbers, officers have to wear clearly marked uniforms, body cameras if they have them. It says the simple possession or use of illegal drugs isn't enough to justify the police breaking down your door. Is that enough of a change? What do you think a SWAT team should look like in this day?
A SWAT team, special weapons and tactics. A SWAT team, in my judgment, should be used only in cases where there is a life-threatening situation where the public is in danger, because you're bringing in heavy equipment. You're bringing in trained, qualified, professional people, supposedly, who are not going to do something that's not unnecessary. I think we have to change the mentality, the concept of officers being able to kill with impunity. When officers investigate themselves, when they commit, you know, when there's an officer involved shooting, for example, if they conduct the investigation, it's not likely that they're going to come up with the evidence that's going to convict one of their own, you know, one of our own, you know. I mean, if we're naturally biased. We're used to rules. We find reasons. The county attorney gets paid by the same county budget that the police department, the sheriff's office does. You know, the government is not going to indict themselves if they can avoid it.
I guess what I'm wondering is, with this increased militarization, can that mentality change happen? I think that one of the people in the documentary says, if you have if all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail, right? You've got the flash bangs and the grenade launchers. It seems like you should use it. How do you change mentality and still have these weapons?
That is going to be the biggest challenge that we have as a society. I'm worried and concerned about the direction that we're going on a national scale. There's a tendency toward creating situations that lead to violence. I mean, during the campaign, there was examples of presidential candidates that were one in particular who was advocating, you know, punching somebody out. I'll pay your legal fees. You know, go ahead, punch him out. You know, I mean, smack him, knock him on his behind. I mean, that's a mentality. That's an attitude, you know, of a bully. That's an attitude of a person who's not professional, who gets off on the idea that you can hurt other people, you can assault and batter other people with no consequence.
So how do we overcome that mentality coming from the top?
It's gone all the way to the top. We've lost our moral compass as a nation in several instances. We lie, we deceive, we say things that are half-truths and spins, and the people, the general population of America, in my judgment, has lost the ability to be able to discern between right and wrong and truth and falsehood. And then the news media is just as responsible as the politicians and the spin doctors and the people who've found that they can get whatever their special interest is, they can accomplish it if they can keep the people uninformed. And so I would I get shot for this, but I consider a large portion of the American public as ignorant, honest Americans. I want more transparency so we're an informed public. I want equality under the law, regardless of how much money you got. Everybody should be treated equally under the law. And this immunity thing, it's probably the most corrupt direction we've ever taken as a nation, to give government officials immunity from prosecution. Even if you have the evidence, even if in internal affairs learns that an officer has confessed internally, if his job is placed in jeopardy, there's a Supreme Court ruling, you know, that says that evidence can't be used against him because it was obtained under duress because he feared for his job security, and therefore he was coerced into a confessing something that he shouldn't have done to an internal affairs officer. So there are cases where the officers can kill with impunity. And when they go back to work after 6 months of paid leave, administrative leave, they haven't even had to go to work, but the taxpayers are paying their salary while they're gone. That hits a victim, a victim's family, relatives, friends, children, parents, grandparents, everybody that's related to a victim or to a person who's been wronged or treated unjustly. We're creating animosity toward law enforcement. And we've evolved to a situation today where there are a lot of people who do not support us as law enforcement personnel. Even the title peace officer near the end, where the sheriff chief of police at the end said, that's the purpose of our business, is being a peace officer. In the film, it's contradictory to me. He is actually pushing the concept, the idea of being tough, and you know, and his protocol and all is conflicting with my concept of peace officer. A law enforcement officer can be anything, but a peace officer, to me, the concept is bringing about peace and harmony, and you do that by treating people with dignity and respect. It doesn't matter if they've broken the law. They still are entitled to be treated like a human being. So, I mean, it's a bigger concept. It's where we can go. It's a realization of Martin Luther King's dream. It's a realization of Abraham Lincoln's dream. You know, we have never in this country had equality that was dreamed of when the Declaration of Independence was drawn up, when the Bill of Rights were written, when the founding fathers of this country made it possible with our set of laws and rules, the supreme law of our land, equality was number one. Equality. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. They're endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, among which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I think America is ready to move to a higher playing field. We've got to rise above this divisiveness, this, you know, accusing each other, bad-mouthing each other, degrading each other, tearing each other down. Politicians in Washington need to stop doing it. The president needs to stop doing it. We need to understand that forgiveness, understanding treating other people with dignity and respect, respecting the Bill of Rights and the Constitution of the United States as a doctrine that brings about peace and harmony and prosperity. That war is going to always be destructive and tear down and waste. It'll always be wasteful. So.
Dub Lawrence, thanks for talking with us.
I apologize for being so long-winded. I could go on for days because I'm on a subject I've been working on for half a century, so we could go for a long time. But thank you so much. It has been a delightful experience. Thank you, Emily.
Dub Lawrence is profiled in the documentary Peace Officer. He talked with WPSU's Emily Reddy about the film, which focuses on the national increase in SWAT teams, including the one that killed his son-in-law. For Take Note, I'm Patty Satalia.